Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Edith Coleman was once considered an outstanding scientist and an investigator of Australian plants and animals, especially Australia's orchids. Edith was self-taught. She had no university qualification and she was a 48-year-old housewife from Blackburn in Melbourne when, in 1929, she presented her first paper to the Field Naturalists Club of Victoria. Despite that late start, she went on to write over 300 articles for newspapers, magazines, and scientific journals until her death in 1951. Her determination, natural curiosity, and remarkable powers of observation earned her many accolades and respect from the science community. It was Edith Coleman who solved the mystery of orchid pollination, which had bewildered Charles Darwin. It took a woman, you see. Edith took her observations very seriously at one time, filling her bedroom with big glass specimen jars of huntsman spiders, something which saw her husband decamp to the sleep out for the duration of those spider studies. Sadly, her remarkable achievements have been, well, all but forgotten, something that author Daniel Claude is determined to change with her delightful book on Edith Coleman called The Wasp and the Orchid, The Remarkable Life of Australian Naturalist Edith Coleman. Well, Danielle, welcome to Open House.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Where did you first come across the story of Edith Coleman?
It was actually one of my first jobs after I graduated from my degree in biology, and I was working at the Museum of Victoria, and I heard about Edith Coleman while I was researching exhibition development and essays that I was writing for the museum.
Was it hard for her to build a reputation?
It's an interesting question, and I think that it probably would have been really hard for her were it not for the role of the Field Naturalist Club of Victoria. So she found an outlet for her interests. She obviously had these interests for a long time, but wasn't actually publishing or writing about it. But one of her daughters actually joined the Field Naturalist Club of Victoria, and the Field Naturalist Club was really set up specifically to engage the general public in scientific investigations, you know, and natural history. So it had a lot of scientists in it, but it also actively encouraged the general public, including women and kids, to be involved.
Yes, there's a photograph of a meeting of the society in your book, and I was very surprised to see almost equal numbers of men and women, and this is now back in the 1920s.
Yes, yes. So that was a really important, you know, part of the club's agenda, if you like, was to have an equal playing field. And it meant that people who just had a general interest in natural history could meet and talk to professional scientists and researchers.
And the other thing I noticed looking at the photo is just how well-dressed they all are.
Three-piece yes,
suits,
smart.
Ladies wearing hats. This doesn't look like the sort of people who go banging around in the bush around Hillsville and Blackburn and Box Hill looking for orchids.
They're often quite well-dressed even on expeditions
as
well.
Really? Oh, my goodness. Where did her love of natural history come from?
She says that it came from her father. And her father was a very keen naturalist. He was a builder. He didn't have any particular, you know, training in this. It was just purely a love of the outdoors. And he was a very keen beekeeper. He belonged to the local beekeeping society. But obviously he gave her a love of nature and her mother gave her a love of literature, both of which she combines in her work.
She went to some unusual lengths to observe. There's a great story about her observing spider habits so she could document them.
Yes. I think one of the interesting things is that, you know, she strongly believed that you didn't have to go very far to do natural history research. You could really do it in your own backyard or, in that case, in your bedroom. Her spider work was all set up in the bedroom. She had great big museum glass jars with boards over the top, and that's where she kept her pairs of huntsman spiders so that she could observe their mating behaviour, which was, you know, she wrote some of the only papers ever written on that subject were written by Edith Coleman. I don't think anybody else has studied it since. But yes, her husband James was less keen on that arrangement and he moved to the sleep out for the duration of the spider studies.
What do you think her scientific contribution was?
Well, you know, I mean, she did discover some new species, and orchid species are always a bit tricky because they sort of, they get lumped together and then they get all split up again and made into separate species, so your discoveries can disappear on you. But she does still have, I think, about five species have been named by her, and that she's got one that's named after her as well by someone else. But I think probably her work, although she did describe species, I think her more important work is her ecological work. So her studies of, for example, spider mating behaviour, but her particular work that she's famous for is her work on pseudocopulation in orchids.
Pseudocopulation. Now, how does that work?
Now, that's a really interesting phenomenon.
I'm sorry, some viewers might find the content disturbing, we should say.
Yes, it is a little bit odd, that's for sure. So most people will be familiar that flowers provide nectar to attract pollinators. Mm. So pollinating insects or birds or mammals even will come to be attracted to the flower to eat the nectar, and as a result they transmit the pollen. They take the pollen from one flower to another flower, and that fertilises the flower. Now, orchids are a little bit of an anomaly because some of them don't seem to provide any nectar, and yet they still have these spectacular flowers that are obviously trying to attract something. So this was a great mystery to orchidologists as to why these plants didn't have nectar. And Edith discovered her daughter actually noticed they had collected some orchids and they were in a vase, and Dorothy noticed that some wasps were entering the flowers backwards, which struck her as a very unusual thing to do because most insects enter head first when they're looking for nectar, obviously. So that led Edith to do a series of studies to try and work out what those wasps were doing, and she soon realised that the wasps were all male. There were no female wasps doing this behaviour, and it didn't take her long to realise that the wasps were mating with the orchids. And this was the payoff for the wasps. So that was the explanation, and this solved a mystery that had puzzled scientists for quite some time.
So the orchids were set up to look like something else.
You'll notice sometimes they look like wasps, they look like female wasps, but more importantly, and Edith didn't have the technology to prove this comprehensively at the time, but she could tell that they must be smelling the flower. Mm-hmm. And we now know from recent studies that the orchids are actually mimicking the pheromone of the female wasp so precisely. It's down to single molecules that they're mimicking. So it's quite a remarkable phenomenon. And so individuals, different species of orchid attract different wasps.
Yeah, that's amazing. Mm. Our guest on Open House is Danielle Claude. Dr. Claude is herself a scientist, the author of The Wasp and the Orchid. And now we know why you've called it that. It's A Remarkable Life of Australian Naturalist Edith Coleman. Does she have any university training?
No, she didn't. She didn't attend university. But she certainly made great use of the public library, which would have had an enormous reference collection. She collected a lot of... She had her own library, which was quite extensive as well. And she certainly went to public university courses. When she was older, she quite enjoyed doing those. I'm not convinced that by the time she was publishing, she needed much in the way of a university education. She seemed to have taught herself it quite effectively, as it was.
I'm really quite intrigued by the idea, though, that she did. She submitted articles for publication. They were published in journals. This was a long time before we were talking about citizen science, as it is known as these days. And even now, I suppose, the divide between the so-called amateur scientist and the professional is still pretty stiff, I would think. Mm. How did she go about having her articles accepted for publication?
It's interesting. I suspect she just read you know, lots of articles herself. So, you know, she was literally self-taught. I think that there's always been a long tradition of amateur science. I mean, really, the very first scientists, of course, were all amateurs. So, yeah, and it was only the very, you know, in the early days of professionalisation anyway. So I don't think it was such an unusual thing. A lot of orchidologists, for example, were people who had other careers. So you might have, you know, ministers of religion or doctors or other people who had this side passion for orchidology. So there weren't a huge number of professional orchidologists. There certainly were overseas.
Do you think we've lost something then without people like Edith around? Or I suppose we still do.
I think we do. We do still have a lot of highly knowledgeable experts in their field who work in amateur science. Astrology, for example, has a huge impact from amateur contributors to that field, and so does biology. So we maybe don't acknowledge them as much. You know, I think natural history is not quite as popular now as it was in Edith's time. It was hugely popular then, so there were a lot more people involved. But I still think they play an important role.
No, I agree with you. Well, thank you for documenting it. Your purpose in doing so was to rescue her from the pages of the footnotes of history.
Yes. Some scientists who work on orchids still remember her. And without that, I don't think anybody would have remembered her at all. But it seemed a shame since she had such a remarkable and unusual career. It seemed a shame not to find out more about her.
Just in closing, tell me about your experience that you've documented in this beautiful book, which is part travelogue, part biography, part kind of unfolding mystery, I suppose, and of course certainly a lot of natural history in there as well. But tell me about your experience of visiting what was her family home in Blackburn Road in Blackburn.
It took me quite a while to work out where exactly the property was, because of course all the road numbers have changed, and Blackburn is completely unrecognisable. There's photos of the area from her time, and it was a dirt road with paddocks on one side and, you know, little wire fences.
Well, it's a metropolis now. It's just part of
and
it.
it's a busy, noisy... it's just completely
congested.
Urban for miles and miles and miles. Yeah, so it's very different. The way if you think about the Heidelberg artists,
yes.
You know, like McCubbin and people like that, they were actually painting around Blackburn. So that's the landscape
yes.
that she knew, and it's now just inner city, really. Mm. But the thing that struck me is I found the location. I was pretty confident I had the right spot, and I realised that the house and garden had been completely demolished and replaced with a 1970s, 80s block of units. So that was quite depressing. But as I stood there peering through the hedge out the front, I realised that the hedge was the original hedge that had always been at the front of Edith's property. So some of the plants and the fig tree out the back and those things had still survived. So you could still see some of her handiwork still surviving.
Wow. It's a good story. It's a great read. Thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you for speaking with us on Open House.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Danielle Clode, the author of that book, The Wasp and the Orchid, The Remarkable Life of Australian Naturalist Edith Coleman.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.